pleasure to introduce Gianpaolo Baretta. Gianpaolo is the Professor of Thermal Sciences at the University di Brescia. He has a 30-year career working in the foundations and applications of thermodynamics and is the co-author of one of the leading textbooks for the so-called Keenan School of Thermodynamics. He has recently been elected the Fellow of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers as well for this work. And today he's going to talk about some of the work that's he's long been working on in terms of the relationship between thermodynamics and quantum mechanics since his time at MIT in the 1980s. With the great title, Mechanics and Thermodynamics Fundamentally United by Density Operators with an ontic status obeying a locally maximum entropy production dynamics, but at what price?
Thank you, Owen, for the kind introduction, and certainly want to thank all the organizers and the Perimeter Institute for hosting this talk and giving me a chance to tell you about this program that I've been working on for quite some time, and to find a way if it, to see if it is possible to think of thermodynamics as a fundamental theory instead of a statistical theory. Now, I think that although it is not mainstream with the rest of the talks, it will certainly belong to this conference in the sense that, as you will see, we will give a new perspective on the quantum state, and so the title seems suited to this kind of approach, which belongs to, as Owen said, to a school of thought about thermodynamics, which in the times of the Prigogine and Brussels school was a sort of antagonistic to their effort, but that, in a sense, as you will see, managed to get to the end one of the programs that Prigogine himself had in his last part of his career. Now, the things I want to talk about are initially something about the notion of individual state and the known conceptual problems of quantum statistical mechanics, and then how we propose to resolve them, including by building this generalization of quantum mechanics that basically embeds thermodynamics into the fundamental theory. And it is based on giving the density operator an ontic status. And once you do that, you need to define also a law of motion. And so I'll tell you about the construction of a maximum entropy production law of motion that gives ontic status and microscopic status to the second law and to irreversibility. But of course, for everything, there is a price to pay, so at the end I will tell you about what this is. And if you're good to me with your questions, I'll even have a small experiment at the end just to entertain you a little bit more. So let's start with the notion of quantum state. And in the times of my doctoral thesis, that was 81, the language was on the distinction between quantal and non-quantal uncertainties. Today's language, I learned in the last few days that I should perhaps rephrase this as on the operational slash instrumental distinction between ontic and epistemic probabilities, or if I were to use von Neumann's language, the 1930s language, I should phrase it on the unambiguous mathematical representation of measurement statistics from homogeneous and heterogeneous ensembles. I'll go quickly on this because everybody in the audience, which is very distinguished, and I'm very honored to speak to you, knows what tomography of a preparation means. Here I want to consider it in a conceptual way without giving yet a mathematical representation to the concept. So I have a preparation that prepares identical replicas of a given system at a given instant of time, and I assume that I can repeat it as many times as I want to construct an ensemble. And then on the ensemble, I can do measurement procedures, and the measurement procedures will give numbers, and if I do enough of these experiments, these frequencies will stabilize somehow, and I could even interpret them as probabilities of outcome of the various possible outcomes. And I do this for all conceivable measurements that I can think of for my system. Once I'm done, there is nothing more I can say about this preparation empirically, and therefore I call this list of numbers that I obtained the tomography of the preparation. It's not the state yet, it's the tomography. Then I have this concept of mixing statistically two preparations. I have somebody tossing a coin with certain bias and picking up systems from one or of two preparations and giving me, and that makes another way of preparing my system, which is as legitimate as any other. And of course, the mean values of observables are going to be a weighted average, and so the tomography will be a weighted tomography of the component tomographies. Now comes the very important definition that Neumann gave of a homogeneous preparation, or at least the same homogeneous ensemble, namely a preparation that no matter how, that gives you a tomography, that no matter how you try different combinations of statistical compositions of different preparations, you cannot find two different preparations that give you the same tomography. So if you cannot do that, you call that a homogeneous preparation. If instead you find two different preparations that mixed somehow to give you the same tomography, then you call that a heterogeneous preparation. Only the homogeneous preparation is a good candidate for, in other words, the statistics of measurement results out of a homogeneous preparation is a good candidate to represent the individual state of each individual member system of your ensemble. And that, so you can say the system, if the preparation was homogeneous, is in state, and the state is represented by the tomography. But that's not enough. You also need an additional condition, which is the fact that whatever mathematical representation you use for heterogeneous preparations, it should have a unique decomposition into homogeneous components. Otherwise, you run into a well-known trouble that was already known to Schrödinger and has been discussed a very long time, and I'm sure we can discuss it also here later on if we want. The problem is this. If I have a preparation with a given tomography and I can identify two homogeneous preparations that give me that tomography when mixed with these weights, then I can conclude that the state of the system, since the state of the system can only be either, in this case, yellow or pink. But if you find also another way of decomposing the same, of obtaining the same tomography as a statistical composition of two different preparations, then from this side you would conclude that the same preparation, so the same ensemble, same tomography, can be interpreted as saying that the state can only be either green or red, and of course this is a contradiction, and that's one of the problems that we've been sort of hiding under the rug for all this time, because there is no solution, and some people just forget about it and use the density operator of quantum statistical mechanics because it works, because it's successful. And some other people, more philosophical, think that we should reject the very concept of the very notion of state of a system, of an individual system. If we rephrase this on the simplest system, the qubit, this is Bloch sphere, and we all know that for such a system, when it is isolated and uncorrelated from the and so unentangled from the rest of the world, the blocks, every point on the Bloch sphere represents a different quantum state. Now, if we want to represent the heterogeneous preparation, that is the composition of, say, this yellow state and this pink state, the von Neumann recipe is that we should represent it by means of a density operator, which, again, in the Bloch representation, will be a point on the chord that joins these two states. But the problem is that through that point, there pass an infinity of other chords. So you can pick just any other state, and then construct a chord that passes through this density operator, and you go on the other side, and then you can consider this density operator as the thing that you would associate with this other decomposition. So we got multiple infinite possible decompositions for a given density operator. So the density operator cannot be the proper representation of a heterogeneous preparation, which is instead the assumption in quantum statistical mechanics. But of course, the density operator, at least its mathematics, is very successful in describing a lot of physics. Bose-Einstein, Fermi-Dirac, Gibbs-Boltzmann statistics, at equilibrium states, they are all based on the density operator. So we are not rejecting that. The successful results we want to keep. But in my view, the correct way of representing a heterogeneous preparation made up of several different homogeneous components would look somewhat like, I can do it mathematically, but pictorially would look like this. I would have to define a probability density distribution over the set of possible quantum states. And so here would be a probability distribution defined over the Bloch sphere. I took the picture of a spiky sphere. This has many spikes, which means that it's a very heterogeneous preparation. But if it was a homogeneous one, I would have a single spike, a single delta function that points on its support to a single pure state. And in this way, I would have a representation that has a unique decomposition into its homogeneous components. Now, the fact is that this is the formula that gives you the expectation value for this kind of the W represent this probability distribution function. The F is the functional of the underlying quantum states. And so you take a weighted sum and you get the expectation value for your heterogeneous preparation. Now, if the underlying functionals are linear functionals of the states, of the quantum state, then you get, by the representation theorem, this trace formula. And the linearity gives you that the expectation value can be written also as a trace of your operator L times another operator, which is the density operator. The density operator is related to the probability density distribution by this formula. The problem is that the density operator is good, as it is enough if you want to represent the linear functionals of the state, but it is not enough if you want to represent other functionals, such as nonlinear functionals. And so this may hint to maybe a hint to the fact that maybe we should look for observables that are represented by nonlinear functionals of the quantum state. So this is a problem. I'm not saying that I have the resolution, but at least I have a way to cast the problem and pose the question. And now this is part of the motivation for which we decided that maybe we gain by, since the density operator is a successful object, why not giving it a fully ontic state, which would resolve. So now what we will do is to assume that the density operator is the thing that represents the underlying quantum state. So the homogeneous preparation has to be described by a full density operator. Now, there are some other motivations that go along with this one, and that come from more exquisite thermodynamic reasoning that has to do with how much energy you can extract out of an equilibrium state, that we call adiabatic availability. Of course, entropy, and also the idea of spontaneous relaxation to equilibrium for an isolated system. In fact, it turns out that this paper has shown that it is, in order to unite mechanics and thermodynamics, it is sufficient to assume the existence of a broader set of ontic states than considered in quantum mechanics. that are basically represented by density matrices, not necessarily fewer, even if your system is isolated, I repeat it, and uncorrelated from the rest of the world. That gives, so that the density operator should not be understood to represent epistemic ignorance as to which particular state your system is really in, because the state is the density operator. And they also showed that the only functional of the state that is a good candidate to represent the entropy is the von Neumann formula for the entropy, which now has a different interpretation, of course, than in Shannon and von Neumann itself. So again, on the Bloch sphere, it means that in addition to the states on the surface, we consider also states that are inside. And the isentropic surfaces are concentric spheres. The isoenergy are planes that intersect the sphere. So if I introduce the energy versus entropy diagram, the blue states are all the states of standard quantum mechanics. And then as I move into the sphere, I go to higher and higher entropy, until I get to a maximum, which is where the a sphere is tangent to this constant energy plane. And that maximum lies on this diameter of the Bloch ball. And as I shift the energy up and down, here is how the entropy goes. Now, of course, since we have broadened the set of states, we need also to say how they evolve in time. And what we would like to have is a dynamical equation that describes the relaxation, the spontaneous relaxation towards equilibrium from any density operator. And this is the next part. We're going to construct it in such a way that if you start from a pure state, you remain pure, so you follow the Schrödinger equation. So basically, we are not going to violate the Schrödinger equation for the pure states. And so we're not going to violate anything that quantum mechanics says, because it has been so successful that there is no reason we should reject it. Before I go into the construction, I'd like to give you an interpretation that I like to, with which I like to think of the eigenvalues of the density operator in this framework. And let me consider a simple case in which the density operator commutes with the Hamiltonian of the system, which, by the way, is the same Hamiltonian that you would give to your system in quantum mechanics. In that case, the mean energy is going to be this weighted sum of the energy, the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian times these quote probabilities. That I prefer not to think of them as probabilities, even if, of course, they are probabilities. They are numbers between 0 and 1. But I like to think of them as being a measure of the degree of involvement of the energy modes of your system, of your particle, in carrying the energy. In other words, if you take the Hamiltonian and you solve the eigenvalue problem, you get the eigenvectors. The eigenvectors are representations of the modes that your system has to accommodate energy. You can accommodate energy in, distribute the energy in the various modes of your system in many different ways. Think of like a rowing team. You may have situations in which you have a strong guy and a smaller guy, and so they have different strengths, different levels at which they can participate into the overall effort. Also, you can have a lazy guy and a non-lazy guy, and so one may be not doing anything and letting the others work. So you see, here is a more mathematical representation of that. These are the degrees of involvement of seven guys in this rowing team, and this is another possibility, and yet another. There are five possibilities. They all have the same mean energy, and they also have the same overall degree of sharing of the energy load. And that degree of sharing of the energy load is what is measured by this the entropy function. If we go again on the energy versus entropy diagram, here are those states that have the same energy and the same entropy, but they are very different non-equilibrium states. Here is the case, a mechanical state in which all the energy would be in one eigen mode, and this is the canonical distribution, the highest possible degree of sharing for the given energy eigenvalues. So what we need is an equation within the possibility to describe all phenomena, including relaxation to equilibrium for an isolated system, and extraction of adiabatic availability, which is the maximum work, mechanical work you can extract out of this non-equilibrium system, which doesn't necessarily coincide to the with the energy that it has. Both these kind of processes require that the eigenvalues of the density operator change, something that cannot be done, as we know, by a unitary evolution which maintains invariant the eigenvalues of rho. And so unitary dynamics cannot help us much with this description. We need something more. You know, what we gain by giving ontic status to the density operator is the freedom from linearity. We are not bound by the epistemic interpretation to have to continue to have a linear law for the density operator, as one would seem to be forced to within the framework of statistical mechanics. In the other direction. So I abandon linearity. I want to obtain basically an equation that does this kind of job, take any distribution and redistribute the load among the as well as possible, and we're going to do it at the fastest possible rate. Notice that we're going to assume that there is an underlying physical law which we basically is an implementation of the principle of maximum entropy production, by which at any given state the system will tend to there is a force that pulls the state in the direction of maximal entropy increase, and that force is competing with the Hamiltonian force that makes it instead recess. So this, what we're going to construct is a theory in which you have two orthogonal tendencies, one described by the minimum action principle that gives you Hamiltonian dynamics, and the other, which is the maximum entropy production principle, which gives you irreversibility. And by the competition of the two, it comes out the sort of engineering that you come out. If you're fast enough and you're able to use the Hamiltonian part, you may be able during this process to interact with your system and get some energy out of the guys that want to distribute energy to somebody else because they're sort of overloaded, and you may take profit of that. If you're not fast enough, then irreversibility will work against you and you will not get any availability out. So that's the program. Now the mathematics. Now, when I started with this business, I used the square root of the density operator simply because it was useful to maintain useful trick to maintain the positivity of the density operator as a function of time. But then later on, thanks to Philip Goyal, who may be in the audience, and I discovered that at the same year of my thesis, somebody else who might also be in the audience has developed a more natural way of representing in geometrical terms a probability distribution that changes in time. And the trick, I have no time to go into the details, but the trick is to, instead of working with probabilities, is to work with their square roots. And then if you represent the vector of probabilities, of square root probabilities, they all map on a unit sphere, and this is the trajectory that you're going to follow. And then you define also a metric, and this metric is important. Now, when I translate that into a density operator formalism, what I can do is to take a density operator, take its positive square root, multiply by some unitary operator, still really irrelevant, like a phase factor that at the end will disappear, and obtain this gamma operator, which now I will call the state. It's actually, you can view it as a vector if you think of the space of linear operators, not necessarily Hermitian, on the Hilbert space of the system, and you equip that space with this kind of symmetrized inner product, a Hilbert-Mitchell inner product. In that view, you see the normalization condition is simply that gamma is unit norm. The Fischer-Rao matrix defines in a nice way a characteristic time with which you are moving along this trajectory. And also, the advantage of this geometrical description is that you can describe, for example, the mean value of the energy and the mean value of the entropy as also scalar products of the state with another vector which you can think of as the gradient of the energy or the gradient of the entropy. These are the variational derivatives of this function with respect to gamma. And also the rate of change of the energy is gamma dot times the gradient, and the rate of change of the entropy is gamma dot times the gradient of the entropy. This is very useful. Now, we can cast standard Hamiltonian dynamics also in this term, in this way. And this is how the Schrödinger equation would look, actually, the Schrödinger von Neumann equation or would look. And would give rise, when translated into density operator formalism, to the standard unitary evolution. Delta H is the deviation, the Hamiltonian minus the mean. And you can check that this gamma is indeed orthogonal to the gradient of the energy and the gradient of and the state itself, so it maintains normalization and energy invariant. It's also orthogonal to the entropy gradient, so it maintains also the entropy invariant. The Fischer-Rao matrix defines a characteristic time of Hamiltonian, which is natural and which enters an exact time-energy uncertainty relation. So this represents the shortest characteristic time of at which any possible observable can change, can vary in Hamiltonian evolution. Now, as I said, we want to describe evolution as a competition of a minimum action part and the maximum entropy production part. So how do we construct the maximum entropy production part? Well, we choose it in the direction, we would like to choose it in the direction of the entropy gradient, but the entropy gradient vector is not really orthogonal to the energy and the normalization gradients. And so we are going to take just the orthogonal part of the entropy gradient. And we use some algebra that allows to do that very easily. It was reminded also yesterday. And at the end, we assume that the rate of change of the state is going to be proportional to the orthogonal component of the entropy gradient of vector. So here's how the final equation of motion comes out. And if we translate it into density operator formalism, the gammas go away, the unitary operator that we used goes away, and only the density operator appears. It has this nice structure, but the M is a very nonlinear function of the density operator itself. It is S minus the Hamiltonian divided by theta. Theta is a functional, which is the ratio of the variance of energy divided by the covariance of energy and entropy. And S is basically the log of rho, plus this little piece that allows you to define it even for when there are zero eigenvalues. But that's really a technicality, because whenever rho appears, it's multiplied by log rho appears, it's multiplied by rho, so there is no problem with the zero eigenvalues. Of course, the dynamics here has a characteristic time, which is still to be understood if it has any meaning, and which could be a constant, a universal constant, who knows, but could also be some positive function of the state operator itself. You can write the rate of entropy generation, the rate of entropy change, which here for an isolated system is the rate of entropy generation, in several forms. And this form, and that form show you immediately that it is non-negative definite because it's like the norm of some vector. The Fischer-Rao metric. Also, for this steepest entropy ascent, part of the evolution defines a characteristic time. And interestingly, this characteristic time enters a new kind of entropy time, time entropy uncertainty relation, which is all to be interpreted. Now, if I take the explicit form of how the eigenvalues of the density operator change with time, this is it. For the special case in which rho commutes with h. So I don't have any unitary part of the evolution, and it's all dissipated. From here, you see that the rate of change of one eigenvalue depends on all the other eigenvalues. So it's a collective decision that at any instant of time the system makes as to how to redistribute the load between the various modes of the system. And you see that when an eigenvalue is zero, this entire line makes this thing zero, and so it will remain zero forever. This is very important because it's a key ingredient in proving that this equation has an existence and uniqueness theorem of the initial value problem. So you give me any initial density operator, and I can solve it, I find a unique solution. Not only it is unique in forward time, but it is unique also backwards in time, which is extremely interesting and important. Of course, the fact that the zero eigenvalues remain zero is key because it forbids crossing, so it forbids any probability to go from positive to negative. It has to go to zero, but if it is zero, it will remain zero, so it cannot go negative. Another way to say this is that the dynamical system that is generated by this differential equation is not a semi-group like the Kosakowski-Lindblad kind of dynamics, which describes another physics because it describes an interaction between a system and environment. Here we're talking about an isolated system. It generates instead a group. So we have a physically irreversible equation which contains an arrow of time, but the mathematical equation is reversible. Something to mumble about. There are also some other appropriate features of the equation that I will skip. They have to do with Gonzaga reciprocity, which you can prove, and it has important implications in non-equilibrium thermodynamics, of course. If you look for what are the states for which the entropy production is zero, that we call the non-dissipative states, they have these structures. This structure where there is a canonical looking part squeezed by between two between a projection operator, just any projection operator. If that projection operator is a one dimensional projection operator, then your state is pure and you recover the Schrödinger dynamics, and which emerges here as a limit cycle of the dynamics. So Schrödinger dynamics is a particular state. It is a limit cycle, and it is mildly unstable. If you take this projector instead to be the identity operator, then you get the canonical distribution. So we get the standard, depending on your system, Fermi-Dirac, Bose-Einstein, and so on. But the important, conceptually, the important aspect of this is that only when you put B equal to the identity, and therefore you get the maximum entropy states, Only these ones are the stable equilibrium states. So the dynamics has many equilibrium states, but the only stable equilibrium states, according to stability, according to Lyapunov, are the maximum entropy states. And this is a very important theorem of this dynamics, because it coincides with the most general statement of the second law that is known, that is, we believe at least, is the Hatzopoulos-Kinnan statement, which reads as, for each given value of the mean energy of a system, there is one and only one stable equilibrium state. And we have shown in the book that was mentioned that from this statement you derive as theorems the other known statements like Clausius, Kelvin-Planck, Karatayodori, and so on. This is like for a four-level system, the set of equilibrium states, these are all the unstable equilibrium states, and the only stable equilibrium states are here. Here I show an example of a numerical calculation where I have I start with an initial state. I give values. I have four rowers, and I give initial weights to their efforts, and then I see them evolve in time towards the canonical distribution, which is this. And here is the entropy that increases in time, and this is entropy generation. But the nice thing is that I can also solve it backwards in time. And if I solve it backwards in time, I can reconstruct and find the ancestral state from which this state came from. And it's unique. And you see that some of the guys were lazy at the beginning and they didn't contribute any. And only in general, two of them, rarely one of them, was taking most of the load. So you see, if it follow backwards the entropy, it goes down in time. It doesn't go to zero, because there may not be zero entropy states compatible with that initial condition. But it's interesting that whenever some guys wakes up and says, well, look, I want to take my part of the energy sharing of the load, there is a burst of entropy production, and because the degree of sharing increases, and this burst ends when the situation becomes optimal for the number of guys that are really doing the job. And when the last guy wakes up and comes into the picture, there is another burst of entropy generation, and you go up to equilibrium. So this is a strong causality. And during these bursts, you actually hit the bound that is given by the time entropy uncertainty relation that I mentioned before. So now the price to pay, which is the last stop. There is no free lunch, perhaps except in these walls. At some conferences, and that has to do with when we have to deal with the composite systems. Because here's the problem. Here's the structure of the equation. Now, if I have a composite system that has a Hamiltonian like that, and if I adopt the equation, this form of the equation of motion, because of the nonlinearity which is contained in this M here, then I would make a wrong description, because I would describe too much coupling between systems that are not really interacting. So what I need to do instead is to describe a proper time evolution. I need to structure similarly to the Hamiltonian also the equation of motion. So in a sense, I have to declare that each of the subsystems has its own way of participating to the entropy increase. Here is again the same equation. And so it does so through some local operators. This is a nice aspect that nice definition of local operators that I've never seen in another framework, and it's a special kind of projection onto the local state of Alice and Bob of the Hamiltonian and of the entropy operator. It basically represents the local perception that the subsystem has of the overall state. And this is nice because it makes the entropy production be the sum of positive numbers that are the local entropy contributions. So that's okay. It's also intriguing because if Alice and Bob get together and interact for a while, then they get entangled and correlated. Suppose that after a while they separated and they go each way different ways. But still, they maintain entanglement and they maintain memory of what happened. And that memory does have an influence on their local time evolution, which is different from something that is typically assumed, that local evolution should depend only on local stuff. Not true in these dynamics, and yet you're not violating any signaling or superluminal stuff. Simply, it's the fact, which is also natural, that if I had the previous experience, my future behavior will depend on that experience as long as the experience fades away. Because, yes, at the end, when I reach stable equilibrium state, they will have decorrelated, and therefore they will have lost that the entanglement and so on. But during the non-equilibrium process, that entanglement has its own importance. So, to conclude, let me just mention that this steepest entropy ascent dynamics has been rediscovered a couple of times recently. The first time was 20 years later that I developed it. But it was nice because it was shown that you can have also a variational formulation, which is in a sense, again, using the square root density operators, but in a variational formulation, which is nice. Some other people, of course, none of them managed to acknowledge the previous work, except here in an addendum after some exchange of emails and so on. We are safe enough because we were lucky that at least at the time somebody picked up this idea, and this was John Maddox, who used to be the editor of Nature magazine, who wrote an editorial in 1985 defining our scheme as adventurous and optimistically saying that it may end arguments about the arrow of time, but only if it works. And I'd like to finish with this with reading what he says here. That is, none of this implies that the arguments about the reconciliation between microscopic reversibility and macroscopic irreversibility will now be stilled. Indeed, while for as long as the present justification of the basis of statistical mechanics holds water, there will be many who say that what we have done is strictly unnecessary. But this is a field in which the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And, I'll skip the measurement effects, and let me summarize what I said. I said basically that the second law can be forced directly into the microscopic laws in such a way that it emerges as a theorem of a constrained steepest entropy ascent dynamics. Entropy emerges from the microscopic level as a measure of the degree of load sharing among the particles' energy levels. Irreversibility emerges as a manifestation of spontaneous internal load redistribution among the initially occupied energy levels. Yet the dynamical equation is mathematically reversible. Non-linearity requires a non-universal formal structure of the dynamical law. The structure is model-dependent, like the Hamiltonian. It depends on what systems you declare to be assumed as elementary and separable, and therefore non-communicating. Standard pure-state quantum mechanics emerges as a mildly unstable boundary solution or limit cycle of the more general theory. The theory is conceptually controversial but mathematically sound and robust and awaits experimental validation and philosophical scrutiny. And therefore, we can say that it is possible that an ontic role of the density operator makes quantum thermodynamics fundamental. Thank you.
I think the first hand I saw up was Philip.
In the pure state description of a spin 1/2 particle, I know the apparatus that I can use to prepare it, It's a Stern-Gerlach apparatus with two detectors, and the apparatus has two knobs on it, so I can set the possibility. So what is the apparatus, the three-parameter apparatus, that I would use to prepare an arbitrary density matrix represented state for the spin one-half particle?
Yes, very important question. And the quick answer is the oven. I would take particles out of an oven where I'm sure that they have somehow thermalized. And then I would have to do something to generate a non-equilibrium state. So, for example, with a laser or something, I could depopulate some of the energy levels in order to make a non-equilibrium distribution and therefore show how it would redistribute.
One particle in the oven. We're talking about the yes. state of a single system. So there's one particle in the oven.
Yeah, but one at a time, of course.
Well, one particle. With one particle, ontic status means I can talk about the individual system in nature. So with one particle, I can certainly prepare it in any orientation spin that I choose. So for this one particle, could you go over again? For this one particle, what I do to prepare it in the density matrix described state?
Well, you see, you sound surprised in what you're saying, which is okay, but the surprise comes from the fact that you're not used to thinking that in terms of the new theory. If you accept this theory, there are such states, even for the single particles, and so it's just a matter of creating them in the lab, if they do exist, which is the question mark. Yes, the single particle has entropy. In an oven, it has temperature, so we are talking about something that, of course, in the standard statistical mechanics course would sound so crazy. You probably fail the student if they tell you that, but this is the idea.
Thank you. I found this approach very interesting, but I guess I'm particularly interested right now with the extent to which the standard description is unstable. So what's the mildness of its instability? And in particular, I'm thinking, what implications for the quest to build a quantum computer would this kind of dynamics have if it were true? So we might expect this to manifest itself in systems moving away from purity faster than decoherence alone would tell us it should. So we might find ourselves having extra problems in trying to create the kinds of states one would need to do decent quantum computation with.
Well, yeah, first of all, I have problems understanding your strict British. So I picked up a few words and I tried to, I picked up the word decoherence. Let me say something about that. So I'm not sure I got your question. I'm sorry. There is a difference between the way people usually understand irreversibility, and the typical description is the one that takes you through like the Kosakowski-Lindblad kind of equation, which comes from taking a system and an environment, which overall evolve unitarily. So you start from standard Hamiltonian dynamics. You make some assumptions, key assumptions, and using these key assumptions, which include the fact that in the environment you're going to lose something, so you need some mechanism that you're not accepting that is there, but it is necessary in order to derive the equation. In any case, you get to an equation, and then you blame the interaction between your system and the environment for being the cause for the coherence. What I'm saying is that maybe this kind of stuff is additional in that derivation and provides an ontic motivation, an ontic reason why there is this mechanism of loss of correlation that you must assume at each state of that derivation. Or let me put it in a different way. The Boltzmann equation, when you derive a Boltzmann equation, you describe particles that collide. After each collision and before the next collision, you assume that they lose correlations. How can they lose correlations if The unitary dynamics cannot do that. So you need something at the single particle level that makes them lose correlation fast enough so that by the next time, the next collision, they'll still be uncorrelated and so on. Otherwise, the Boltzmann equation is not justifiable. Yet, the Boltzmann equation is a very good description of certain gases, including dense gases.
Sure, I'd understood the distinction between your program and the standard decoherence story. My question was, to what extent would the truth of this theory make it harder to create sufficiently pure states in the lab to do quantum computation with? And do we already know whether or not this dynamics is kicking in virtue of those kinds of experiments where we try and do quantum computation in the lab?
Well, if this theory is true, it would mean that pure states are, as I said, mildly unstable, which would mean that very near a pure state, there would be a mixed state, which eventually, it may take a long time, but which eventually will fly away and go to the maximum entropy. So that will define the time, a lifetime, and a framework in which you probably have to deal with in order to control your information, I mean, computation stuff.
But how mild is mild? Do you have any sense of the parameters here?
No, the parameters, no, because, of course, it all depends on that constant tau. But the asymptotics, is that it is a double exponential, both the approach to equilibrium and the going backwards in time towards the limit cycle. So the double exponential gives you a fact that it is not. It may take a very long time before it wakes up. That's all I know so far, but I'm looking for help.
So I think there are various problems when you introduce nonlinearities into the evolution of the density matrix. So one is the problem you mentioned of the possibility of signaling. But the other problem, I think, is less discussed, it's the following. In standard quantum theory, the formula for calculating probabilities is linear in the density matrix. It's the probability is given by the trace of some positive operator times the density matrix. If you regard a measurement as consisting, in general, of some evolution followed by a measurement, and if the evolution is nonlinear, then in fact that formula will cease to be linear. You will now have a nonlinear equation for calculating probabilities. So now if you think about what that means, you can, in standard quantum theory, you can represent a density matrix. You can represent a mixture of pure states by a density matrix using n squared parameters. N squared is the number of parameters appearing in the density matrix. And mathematically, that can be understood as a convex mixture of all the extremal states. But if now, and that's because you have this linearity in the formula, if you now break that linearity you now calculate, you now look at the extremal states in your new set and take mixtures of them, it's possible that you'll have the dimension of the convex hull will be larger than n squared.
Definitely.
In other words, your new mixed states will be represented by some mathematical object which is different from the density matrix. So now, in that case, you may still have the problem that there is a non-uniqueness of the decomposition, that the new things that represent extremal states, which would be your density matrices, if you now take a mixed state in the new theory, it may have a non-unique decomposition into the objects that represent extremal states. And so it may be that you haven't solved the problem that you were starting with at the beginning of your talk.
No, yeah, but yes, very correct, of course. And I thought about it already in the 80s when I was doing that. So the idea is that, of course, that if, let me do it pictorially, if this is the set of density operators, let me represent this. So every point in this set represents a different density operator. And the density operator represents the homogeneous preparation, so it's the underlying state. Now, suppose I want to describe a heterogeneous preparation, what would be the description? And the description would be a distribution function that may look like that, defined over this set of density operators. And the pure ones would be the delta functions, that has a single point support, and of course it's not a point, it's a density operator. So, and so, as we know, if you take any distribution, it can be uniquely decomposed as a sum, or actually an integral of delta functions, and so that decomposition is unique in the same sense as the spiky sphere that I presented when the underlying states, instead of being the density operator, are the pure ones. So there is a mathematical way to describe, certainly it's not going to be the density operator, you need something more. And I agree with you that whenever you have a function describing something, you need an infinity of measurements in a sense to do it, but maybe you can find some kind of Fourier transform of that function that makes it a countable set and makes it a bit easier. But I agree, there is a difficulty.
If it's unique, then I'm not so good at thinking in the case where you have a continuous set of states. Certainly, in the discrete case, if the decomposition is unique, then that means that you have simply classical probability theory, and I imagine that would apply also in the. In the continuous case, and that would suggest that really you just have classical theory, that there's no such thing as a superposition of different states.
Yeah, because that's correct. Because when you're describing the heterogeneity of the preparation, those are classical probabilities that you are superimposing onto the ontic state. The ontic state has intrinsic probabilities, whether it be a pure state or a density operator state. But the flipping of a coin, so to speak, is a classical part, and you describe it like in classical mechanics with a probability density distribution over a phase space. The only difference is that in classical mechanics you got Qs and Ps, in quantum mechanics you got pure states, in this stuff you got density operators.
So just one last question then. Does there exist in principle a process, so some nonlinear evolution followed by a measurement, that would distinguish any two distinct density matrices in a single shot?
I wish. I don't know, but it may be, but my mind is not large enough to think of it at the moment. I hope somebody will pick up on this, because the mathematics is interesting.
I'm wondering about experimental tests. Those very nice diagrams of the eigenvalues as a function of time with two bursts of entropy production, I think that kind of evolution is very different than what you'd get in the more familiar statistical mechanics theories, and therefore you shouldn't have too much trouble devising an experiment to test it. Have you given some thought to how you could experimentally test those very interesting looking evolution diagrams that you showed us?
Well, the only calculations that I managed to make with a very big effort was try to implement this into the standard quantum electrodynamic description of things like stimulated emission, resonance fluorescence, and absorption from a single atom What I found is that if there is this internal redistribution of the within the single atom, then you would find some asymmetries in, like this is what the spectrum of resonance fluorescence, and it has the two stark shifted peaks, and you would get some asymmetry. But of course, I tried to talk to some experimentalists and convince them that maybe you could go and try an experiment, a little experiment. The typical answer I would get, well, I don't believe your theory is right, so I'm not going to waste my time on your theory, which is, acceptable. So far, I haven't managed to convince anybody to think too much about this.
I was wondering how long the demonstration would take.
Forgot about it. I thought that there is a tradition in Denmark. Once a year, you sort of burn your witches on the beach. And so I thought that it could be a nice tradition. I mean, to keep the tradition is to burn the beaches here. And I sort of identified the witches, which are the ontic state and the epistemic psi. So I'm going to try this experiment. It's new also to me because I did it with just one. Now I'm doing it with a pair. So they might get entangled in some way. Why? What's the reason? Well, it's also a little tribute to Carnot, because it will show you the motive power of fire, and I hope the fire detector will allow us to do it. So, be ready for. Are we ready? Yeah. To burning our witches. Okay. And then I will put off the fire. And, well, it didn't suck it completely, but at least we got an even distribution between the two. So I don't know if this, you can interpret it in any way. Maybe it's an ontic interpretation of the coffee breaks, because this was coffee, or maybe whatever. But that's it.